Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Ian Parsons. He has spent years birding in Spain, leading bird tours there, and we're talking about his book that he's just written, A Vulture Landscape, 12 Months in the Extremadura. Ian, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk about this book. It's a beautiful book.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. Much appreciated.
What I like about it is it really sets a sense of place. I've been to another part of Spain, and I can tell you, like, the way that you talk about the land and the birds in it and the other animals in it, it really is about that place. Now, for people who don't know, where is Extremadura?
Okay, well, Extremadura is a region of Spain to the west of Madrid. It's basically between Madrid and Portugal, and it's completely landlocked. It's a big area, but it's got very few people, so it's a fantastic place for wildlife. There's very few people, large open spaces, lots of different habitat, and it's a fantastic birding destination for a lot of Europeans, but it's also very good for lots of other species as well.
Is most of the land preserved or saved in some way?
There are various national parks, and there's various other designations, but most of it is very good because of a lack of people.
That's one of the things that worries me, by the way. When I hear about a large, cool area like this, the first thing I think of here is like, oh my God, in another 10 years, is it going to be built up on?
Yeah, I mean, that is a worry. I mean, Spain itself is undergoing a bit of a migration of people from rural areas into cities. So it's actually emptying of people rather than filling
up. Oh, weird.
But also, the landscape is very harsh. I mean, the summers in Extremadura are very extreme. I mean, over 40 degrees centigrade, for weeks on end is typical. And that makes it very hard to get any subsistence out of the land. I mean, farming is very, very extensive. They just cannot farm it intensively like we can in Britain, for example.
Now, this is a book about your love of watching vultures. When did you start getting interested in vultures?
I first saw a vulture in 1995 in the wild in Extremadura, and there's something about them. I don't know what it is. I can't put my finger on exactly what clicked inside me, but just seeing vultures I find it amazing. They're big, massive birds. They're generally in a beautiful blue sky. You've generally got the sun on you. I just find it incredibly relaxing and just, I don't know, it's a fantastic experience.
Well, first of all, we have to mention for people who are North American listeners, which are most of them, these are not the vultures we have here. For most of the United States, we have the black vulture, and especially in the south, although they're moving north, and we have the turkey vulture, and they are large birds, don't get me wrong, but they don't compare at all to watching a griffin vulture. A griffin vulture is first of all, it looks like the vultures you see in Egyptian art. It looks like the vultures you see in cartoons. These are big, hulking vultures.
They are. And I mean, you've got two families of vultures in the world. You've got what they call the old world vultures, so the vultures of Europe, Asia and Africa, and then the new world vultures, so the vultures of the Americas. And they are actually fairly unrelated. They're not closely related at all.
They think our vultures are more closely related to storks.
Well, that's been said, but I think actually that's been analyzed a bit further, and that's largely been disproved now. But they're not similar families. It's just that they've got big, broad wings, and they've evolved a similar way of living. So we just tended to lump them together as vultures. But the griffin vulture is a huge bird. And then to confuse things in Europe, we've also got something called a black vulture, although it goes under various names. But it's very different to your black vulture, and it's huge.
It's even bigger than the griffin vultures.
It is bigger, yeah. I mean, its wingspan is just under 3 meters, so it's about 10 foot. Jeez. I mean, it's a massive, massive bird.
Wow.
And, you can get very close to them. They can fly. I've had one come very, very close to me overhead, and it's, wow. I mean, you're just rooted to the spot, you know. The sun disappears, and it's just this big black bird flying right over you.
Now, there's another species of vulture, and these are very odd-looking, the Egyptian vulture. Describe that for the audience, because they're smaller, and they're very odd-looking to me.
They are. They've got a very small head. They've got their face is egg yolk yellow. They've got a very puny little bill compared to what most vultures have. They're white and black plumage. They're a strange bird. They're not very big. They're They're about as big as a typical heron, which is still a big bird, but in comparison to the other vultures, wingspan-wise, they're quite a bit smaller. They do the... Well, you know, I mean, vultures are recyclers, and Egyptian vultures do the sort of the dirtiest of the jobs, if you like. They pick up the bits the others don't want. they're an interesting-looking bird. They're a funny-looking bird. I always think they've got this yellow face, this pointy face, and they've got feathers at the back of their head that often stick up in the air. And for me, growing up in the 1980s, they always remind me of Doc Brown out of Back to the Future. Which is, I know, is a strange analogy, and you won't find that in any bird books.
No, you won't.
That's
no, you won't.
How my mind works.
Now, I want you to describe the land for a bit for me, so people can get a picture in their mind. Extremadura is a fascinating place. I birded in places like it when I birded up northwestern part of Spain. Mm. But it's an extreme environment.
It is. I mean, you've got rolling plains. Very, very open areas, very, very thin soils. You've got a mountain range in the north of the region which comes in, which has snow. I mean, you know, very, very high peaks, whereas the plains will never get any snow. You've got very, very deep, steep-sided river valleys. I mean, the real gorges through the landscape. And then probably the biggest land use are oaks on grazing, and they're evergreen oaks that are, they sweeten the hams of the pigs. By the pigs feeding on the acorns, and you know, Iberian ham is a delicacy, and it commands a high price, and that's pigs that are fed outside under the acorns for several months before they're slaughtered. And also some of the oaks are cork oaks, producing the cork bark, which obviously we use in the manufacture of all sorts of things, you know, most famously the corks that go into the bottles of the wine that Spain's famous for producing as well. And it creates an almost savanna-like habitat, so almost a bit like when you watch the wildlife documentaries about Africa and you have the savanna landscape.
Yeah.
It's very, very similar to that. It's artificial, the oaks. You know, they're planted and they're maintained, they're pruned, but they're very important for farming because they cast shade, and that shade is vital during the summer months for the livestock, and it also protects the soils. It stops the very thin soils from washing away in the heavy rains that they do get at times in the winter.
Now, there's a lot of bird life. And the landscape may look extreme and look like there's not going to be a lot there. And people who look at photographs in your book, and I want to mention the book is just covered with color photographs, but there's a wide variety of bird life that's found. Let's talk about the larks first.
Oh, the larks are just fabulous. And the song, it's wall-to-wall sound. I mean, in the book, there's a picture of the plains, and all you can see in it is one big, large bull just stood there, sort of reddish cow, just stood in the middle of nothingness, really. But, you know, they always say that about a photo, a picture paints 1,000 words, but what you don't have in a photo is sound. And the sound of the larks on the plains, it's incredible. It really is. You've just got this song tumbling out of the sky from a few different species, and it's just there. And in the end, you actually get so used to it, you don't notice it, which is mad when you think about it when you're not there, but when you're there, it's just a constant noise, a beautiful noise.
And there's bustards there.
And there's bustards.
You know, and people in America probably have no, for the most part, don't have any idea what bustards are, but they are a very cool group of birds.
Yeah, I mean, you've got great bustard and little bustard in Extremadura, and great bustard is the world's heaviest flying bird. They are massive. They are huge, big, powerful birds that are incredibly wary of people. They live out on the very, very open plains. They don't like clutter in the landscape. They like it to be open so that they can see. And they're very clever because they'll spot you before you spot them. And instead of taking to the air, which would make them extremely noticeable, they just wander off. They use the landscape. They use the folds in the landscape to just keep away from you and just walk off. And, you know, I run bird tours out in Extremadura, and they're a bird that everybody wants to see. And they can be particularly tricky to spot. Because they're very wary, their camouflage is very good when they're not flying, and they're just very subtle birds, even though they're huge. I mean, you know, like I say, the biggest, the heaviest flying birds in the world, and they can blend into a landscape very, very easily.
Little bustards are not as dramatic as all.
No, they're not as dramatic. They have a great call.
It's
like someone blowing a raspberry at you, and it drifts on the air. It's like it's a very good ventriloquist trick because you can hear it and you think, oh, that must be very close. It must be right in front of me, and it could be a long way away. It's very, very far carrying, very deceptive. They're very small. They can be really difficult to find, especially when the grass is up in the spring. So you've got long vegetation because they're quite a small bird. They're not nowhere near as big as their cousins. And sadly, they're in massive decline across their range in Europe. No one's quite sure what's going on, but they're a bird that is doing well in Extremadura, but they're becoming a harder bird to find.
Now, let's talk about the nesting habitats of the different vultures. Where would a griffon vulture nest?
Griffon vultures are cliff nesters generally. They like to nest on rocky ledges, on cliffs. So some of these steep-sided river valleys that I've said about have these natural cliff sides. They're very popular. Quarries, there's an old quarry that I mentioned in the book. I start the book in, and that's got a huge colony of griffon vultures in it. Mountainsides. In the very north of Spain, up by Santander, there's even a colony that nests on the sea cliffs, which I find incredible. I grew up in the southwest of Britain on the coast, and we have seagulls flying around.
Weird. I can't imagine them flying out over the ocean.
I know. And you can just imagine sort of lying back on the sun on a nice summer's day on a beach, and a big shadow goes over you, and it's a griffon vulture flying over. That must be incredible to experience. They're cliff nesting birds, and the Egyptian vulture also nests in cliffs, but it prefers sort of little caves, sort of nooks in the cliff face, if you like, that it can get into. And then the black vulture, the biggest of all, you'd think would be another cliff nester, but it actually prefers nesting in trees, and they make just stupendously massive nests in the tops of these rounded evergreen oaks, which aren't very high. They're not massive trees, but they've got big wide branching, and they nest in them, and they'll go back to the nest year on year. And considering they can live for 30 years, they could be breeding in the same nest for 20-25 years, and they add to the nest every year, so eventually the tree starts to collapse under the sheer enormity of this nest. I mean, they're huge nests. I mean, you're talking, if you imagine the typical double bed size, that's kind of the size of the nest, and then it can be meters deep, which has been built up over the years. I mean, they're phenomenally big nests, huge things.
Now, the other thing that's a big feature of your book, there's lots of other species of raptors that are found in this area. When I birded Spain, I thought the raptor situation there was just incredible.
Yes, it's, coming from the southwest of Britain, which is a raptor poor area, really. And going there for the first time, it blew my mind. I mean, you've got three species of vulture. You've got five species of eagle. There's lesser kestrels. There's kestrels. There's peregrine falcons. There's hobby. You've got marsh harrier, hen harrier, Montague harrier, which are three beautiful birds. There's a bird called black-shouldered kite, which is it's almost like a ghost the way it flies, and it flies at twilight, and that's a beautiful bird. You've got red kite. You've got black kite. It's stunning. It really is. I mean, when I take the clients bird watching, they cannot believe the raptors. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, you can just be sat there and suddenly you look up, and you can be sat in a town and look up and you've got vultures drifting over the town, and you've got black kites checking out the sides of the street to see if there's something edible that someone's discarded. I mean, it's for someone who grew up in Britain, where we have a lack of raptors, really. I remember my first time out there. It was incredible. It's an incredible experience.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Ian Parsons. He has spent years birding in Spain and leads bird tours there. But we're talking about his new book, A Vulture Landscape, 12 Months in the Extremadura. I want to talk about griffon vultures, especially flying. Mm-hmm. I love how you describe it. Vultures are amazing soaring birds. They can read the air, but we are illiterate. Elaborate on that.
Well, when you watch them, you realize that they never like to flap their wings. Vultures are all about efficiency. And we look at the air, and to us it's a void. but a void is something that's empty, and it isn't. There's currents of air moving through it all the time at different speeds and at different, you know, different directions. And somehow the vultures just seem to be able to pick the right path through the air. And I don't know how they do it. I mean, you can get very scientific and say it's about them detecting air pressure, but they're reading the signs, they're reading the air. I always say to the clients, because many of my clients love to take photos, and you can be in a river valley and a griffon vulture will suddenly appear one side without flapping. It will just go straight across the valley and disappear. And I always say to them, instead of trying to get onto that first bird and really never quite catching up with it, point your camera at where it first appeared, because that's where the second one will come from, because it will follow, it will read what the other one's done, it will read how that one's flown across this valley, which could have lots of turbulence in it potentially. It will see how it's done it without any effort, and it will follow the exact same path. And they do, they read the currents of the air. They want, at the end of the day, a vulture is a very, very lazy bird. It doesn't want to expend any energy. It wants to take the easiest path through the sky, and it does so by watching not just other vultures, but watching what other birds are doing as well. They're incredible. They really do read it. And it's something that we can't comprehend.
Now, what they're looking for is they're looking for carrion, especially like dead cattle. Yeah. And it was amazing to me. I read on the average, once they spot a dead cow and they'll all watch each other and they all start to go down, within about 5 minutes, it's nothing but bones.
Oh, they're very efficient flyers, but they're incredibly efficient at clearing up a carcass. And I think it's for a sheep carcass, I think they've said about when one bird, you start your clock, first bird lands by the sheep, and within 3 or 4 minutes, that sheep will just be gone. And it rains vultures. Once the first one's gone down, the rest all pile in. And the reason why you always see vultures in the sky in Extremadura is because they're always watching for food, but also watching what other vultures are doing. They spread themselves out across the sky, and when one vulture suddenly changes course or looks to be interested in something, the vultures that can see that bird will start heading in its direction, and the vultures that see those vultures heading that direction will also head in that direction. And the sky can go from having one or two vultures in it to having literally hundreds of vultures within minutes, and they circle over the carcass to make sure that it's safe. You know, these are birds that have grown up with things like wolves and other predators. So, they're wary. They won't come straight down to the ground. So they'll circle for several minutes. And that's when you get these wonderful images of the sky full of clouds of vultures, if you like, circling over something. And then as soon as the first one breaks ranks and drops, they all go. And there's no table manners. It's a free-for-all, a complete free-for-all.
Egyptian vultures, though, are on sort of the periphery.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not in there in the big throng. The black and the other big vulture, the griffon vulture, they're in there tearing it up and fighting with each other. And you'll see the relatively small Egyptian vultures on the periphery, waiting their turn, waiting for everybody else to be finished.
Yeah, I mean they're not big enough to compete with the other species. And also, their bill isn't very strong. Vulture actually comes from a Latin word that means to tear, to rip. And, that's what vultures do. They rip the carcasses open. Well, an Egyptian vulture doesn't have that sort of bill. It needs to wait for the others to feed anyway. But occasionally, you'll see one try and sneak in and grab something. But, I mean, you can have well over 100 griffon vultures at a carcass. And, a cow's a big animal, but you put 100 big vultures around it. The poor old little Egyptian vulture's got no chance of getting in there. But, they hoover up the bits at the end, all the trampled guts and what have you that's left, they'll clean up. And, I can remember many years ago when I was first out there, the light was beginning to go, and there was a dead cow I'd noticed. And I thought, that's annoying. It was an annoying time and day for me. So I went out there as soon as I could in the morning. It probably took me about half an hour to get out there. And there was absolutely nothing left. There was the big bones, and the ground was all trampled around it, and there was the odd bit of broken feather because the vultures fight each other over the choicest morsels. But there was nothing left. I mean, everything was gone. There was no flesh there, and that makes them so important in clearing up carcasses that could potentially harbor diseases because they just destroy it. There's just nothing there. They're the ultimate recyclers.
Are they detecting the carcasses visually or olfactorily?
Well, this is one of the two big differences. This is one of the main differences, between the old world vultures and the new world vultures, and that the old world vultures don't have a sense of smell. So they're totally reliant on spotting them from the sky. While some of your vultures in America, I mean, the turkey vulture and the yellow-headed vultures, they do have a sense of smell, and they can pick up on the decomposition. And they then obviously then use their eyes to sort of hone in. But smell is an important factor for some of your species, not all of the American species, but some of them. So in Europe, no, they're purely looking and they're purely scanning the landscape, reading the landscape, reading what other birds are doing. So if they see a raven taking interest in something, ravens are carrion feeders, it's worth the vulture checking out what the raven's checking out. So in Europe, they're certainly visual. In America, some species do use their sense of smell, which is a very unusual sense in the bird world.
Yeah. And part of it may be that, for instance, here in the Northeast, there's too much forest cover. So it's not like being in Extremadura where you have these wide open flat spaces. So they can spot things. But here, it really helps if you can smell. And I've seen turkey vulture flocks in the middle of the forest on a carcass that they could only find by smell. What are they now? They've gorged themselves on this carcass. They don't just then take off, do they?
No, they're very reluctant to take off. I mean, they'll sit and digest their food. I mean, they're literally allowing their food to go down, I suppose, is the human expression, isn't it? They'll sit and they'll just wait. I mean, they'll fill their stomachs up, but they'll also fill their crop up as well. You know, being a carrion feeder, you never know where your next meal is coming from. So
right.
if you can store, you know, just take a little carry out with you as well, then, you know, that's what they do. So they're heavily loaded. And, they can take off, but it's a real effort for them. It's a real struggle. And you tend to find once they finish feeding, they tend to sort of move themselves uphill if there's a hill. So they've got a slight rise. A, that gives them better visibility, but also if they need to go, they can sort of run downhill and eventually get up enough speed to get to the air. It's a bit like watching the old Flintstone cartoons and their aeroplanes, you know, when they're running along with their feet, trying desperately to get some height. They wait. They allow their food to go down before they take to the air if they can help it. They don't like flying once they've fed.
Now, this amazed me, and I didn't know this until I read your book. Rapel's vulture is starting to show up in Spain?
It's very strange. I mean, they're critical.
That's an African vulture. I mean, that's found pretty far south in Africa.
Yeah, I mean, it's sub-Saharan. It's down, you know, right down into Central Africa. And they're in big trouble. They've suffered very badly at the hands of deliberate poisoning. And their numbers are crashing. But with griffon vultures, when the young fledge, they don't breed again for 4 or 5 years. So a lot of them wander, and they wander quite long distances. And some of them, a lot of them, cross over the Mediterranean and go into Africa, and they explore around Africa. And some of them go down into sort of the tropics of Africa, the northern tropics, and they're meeting Rupel's vultures, which are very similar species.
Yeah, yeah.
That are also wandering. Young birds are wandering as well. It's kind of like the gap year, really. You know, they go on this holiday, this extended sort of traveling break. And they meet up, and then as the young griffon vultures head back up to Spain for the spring, some of these rupels tag along, and they cross over the Straits of Gibraltar and into Europe. And I think it was the early 90s they were first officially proved, if you like, of being in Spain. And there's been a couple of breeding attempts, but they're young birds, so they're unlikely to be colonizing. They're just wanderers. They've probably always done it. It's just that now with more and more bird watchers and people, you know, with much better optics and cameras now, you can just point up and take a picture and then zoom in and be able to analyze what you're taking a photo of. I think people are more readily spotting the fact that occasionally, and it's we're talking very small numbers, but occasionally Rupel's vultures do drift into Spain.
What's the biggest cause? We're going to run out of time. What's the biggest cause of mortality among the Spanish vultures?
It's humans, as always. There is a little bit of poisoning still. Most of it now, though, isn't deliberate. So ingestion of lead is a big problem from lead shot. Because obviously if an animal's winged and it goes off and dies, well, the vultures are the ones that clear it up, and they're clearing up the lead as well as the meat. Collision with pylons, electricity lines, wind turbines are a big issue in some places. So with most things, you know, mortality of animals, it can usually be traced back to humans and what we do.
But in India, there's a massive die-off of vultures due to ingestion of chemicals.
Yeah, and that is a chemical called diclofenac, which is an anti-inflammatory. Well, we humans take it, you know. Anti-inflammatory drugs often contain diclofenac. And it's fine for mammals to take, but unfortunately it kills birds. And carrion feeders, they eat it, and it concentrates in large doses in their bodies, and it causes their kidneys and their livers to pack up, and that leads to death. And it wiped out 99% of the vultures in India. Before anyone knew what was happening, no one knew what was causing this great die-off. They found it, luckily, just in time. I mean, a bird called the white-backed vulture was the commonest large raptor in the world, and now there's just about 10,000 left. I mean, there were millions, and they just got wiped out. And, you know, a lot of the countries in the subcontinent of Asia have banned it, but still the European Union hasn't banned this drug in agricultural use. Luckily, there are other drugs that are available, and for whatever reason, the farmers of the EU tend to use those drugs as opposed to diclofenac. But the potential's there, which I find ridiculous. Nowadays, wow. We know what it can do, and it's still potentially available for use as a veterinary product, and that's scary.
We're almost completely out of time. What's the best month to bird the Extremadura? For you?
For me, I mean, I love it all year, but April, May time is the time because your spring migrants, your colourful birds like your bee eaters and your rollers are coming back then. And obviously everything's breeding, so there's a lot of activity. And the weather is lovely, but it's not too hot.
My guest tonight has been Ian Parsons. He's spent years birding in Spain. He leads bird tours there, and he's written a book about his love of the area. It's called The Vulture Landscape, 12 Months in Extremadura. Ian, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.